Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Seattle, Washington. And we are again in the show today with us, Dr. Paul Nelson. And if you aren't sick of Paul Nelson yet, well, you will be soon. He's done a great job talking about common descent with us. And I'll just give our listeners a little secret that sometimes when we have special guests in the area here in Seattle, we'll actually just basically tie them to a chair and make them sit there for about an hour or 2 hours while I grill him with questions. And that's what we've done to Paul Nelson today. He's being a great sport, talking to us about common descent. I hope you don't mind this too much.
Well, the ropes aren't chafing yet.
The ropes aren't chafing yet. All right. Well, I can see you've got the pin in your mouth here, and you're trying really hard to undo the lock. So if you hear some teeth and some gurgling, that's probably Paul here. We've been talking about common descent now. This is actually the fifth podcast that we're doing. And we've sort of moved up the tree of life as we've gone along. Again, to just recount, we started at the origin of the genetic code. We moved on to the root of the tree of life. We talked about moving up the tree of life to the level of what is the relation of animals. And we're actually going to continue with that theme a little bit today, and we are eventually going to get to Paul's family history. So this paper that I want to talk about today, again, is by Antonis Rokas and Sean B. Carroll, published in Public Library of Science in just at the end of 2006, last November. And as we talked about in the last podcast, both of these scientists are very committed neo-Darwinists. There's really no reason to suggest that they are skeptics of neo-Darwinism or that they support intelligent design. So off the bat, just so there's no mistake, you know, we're discussing a controversy within evolutionary biology right now. How do they deal with conflicting data that is not presenting a clear picture of common descent? Is that a fair characterization of what we're talking about right now?
I think so. These are very bright biologists trying to understand how to make sense of the history of life in terms of the evidence they have available to them, both in overall morphology, the anatomy of an organism, but also in its molecules, in its proteins and DNA.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like Sean B. Carroll. He's a
wonderful writer, very creative, hardworking biologist, and writes great books.
He does write great books. I really enjoyed reading and reviewing his book, Making of the Fittest, recently. And also, late at night sometimes when I can't sleep, I go on and turn on University of Washington as a public access channel here in Seattle. And they have these lectures with Sean Carroll where he's kind of, it's sort of actually, I mean, I hate to say it, but it looks kind of like a televangelism show. He has all these students. And they're all looking very intently, you know, smiling. And it does look extremely staged. But his lectures are still really interesting. I mean, I'd much rather watch that than any televangelist show in the middle of the night, I think, for sure. And you've got pictures of, you know, skeletons and bugs on the wall. You've got all the, you know, the same exact setup, except it's just a slightly different topic. But I think the intent might be the same as well, actually. In any case, but again, I do enjoy the lectures, and they're very interesting. And I like his scientific research because I think he's very candid, and he's trying to direct the field of systematics in a direction where it can really, you know, accommodate the data. And we're going to talk about, you know, the theme that's been going through this is, can evolutionary biologists deal with the data when it conflicts with the predictions that were made of their common descent hypotheses? And so right. We're going to look at how is Sean Carroll and Antonis Rokas, how are they dealing with the data when it conflicts with their hypothesis? So in this paper published in Public Library of Science in November 2006, they actually acknowledge that, quote, a large fraction of single genes produce phylogenies of poor quality. And they even observed that one study, quote, omitted 35% of single genes from their data matrix because those genes produce phylogenies at odds with the conventional wisdom, unquote. So, Dr. Nelson, what does that tell you, what they're saying here?
Well, let me give you a metaphor, if you will, for thinking about this. And it has to do with how our theories generate expectations. Imagine that you're in a train station, this is an old-fashioned metaphor, with a timetable on the wall, and the timetable tells you when the trains leave and arrive, and you're waiting for your train, and the station master is there, and you look at your watch, and you realize that your train, going to Peoria, let's say, is 45 minutes late. So you walk up to the station master and you say, hey, where's my train? I'm going to be late for my appointment in Peoria. And there's a big sign outside that says all the trains run on time, all the time. And he doesn't shrug. He doesn't even bat an eye. He says they do run on time all the time, except when they don't. Now, think about that in terms of science and making predictions. If your theory tells you, let's say, theory of common descent tells you that DNA, when it's sequenced and aligned, and you look at the patterns that that generates in terms of branching trees for evolution, that that will fit with what you expect from classical anatomy or other lines of evidence, except when it doesn't, what does that theory really tell you about the world? I think that there is a methodological problem with much of the work done in molecular evolution, where one enters the investigation already with an expectation about the answer that you're going to find.
Hmm.
The deep expectation for evolutionary theory is that organisms will fall into a tree-like pattern with roots that go back to a single organism deep in the history of life. In other words, the data ought to tell you that Darwin's tree is real and that all organisms can be fit into that tree in some way or another. If the data don't tell you that, then one might say, well, I've got a bad molecule here. I've got a bad protein. I've got a bad gene. It's not behaving as it should. I'll leave it out of the analysis. Mm-hmm. Well, is that very much different from the station master telling you the trains all run on time except when they don't? If data don't fit your expectations, it may be that your expectations are what is leading you astray. All the time in science, we have a dialogue going between us and nature herself. We come to nature with our theories, and this is the case not just in biology, of course, but in physics and cosmology and elsewhere. Our theories never quite fit the way they should with the world. The world talks back to us, the evidence talks back to us, and we correct our theories in the light of how they don't fit with the world. We make predictions, they don't turn out, we have to go back and look at our theories. The problem is, for evolutionary theory, if it's formulated in a way that it has lots of escape hatches, now here I'm mixing metaphors, mixing trains and submarines, if you will, but it's got lots of escape hatches or ways that allow you to eliminate data from your analysis when it doesn't fit or to lay them to one side and so forth, are you really running the risk of falsifying your theory? Are you really confronting your theory with the evidence, or are you tailoring the evidence in a way that it fits with the theory? Methodologically, I think there are real problems here.
Mm. So another way that the systemists of the evolutionary biology community have tried to resolve, you know, data that doesn't fit is, as we talked about, I think, in a previous podcast, is they've said, we just don't have enough data, and we need to collect more. And if we collect more, the true signal will come in, even if it's maybe perhaps a weaker signal. Now, this paper is very interesting because it actually states that certain critical parts of the tree of life may be, quote, difficult to resolve regardless of the quantity of conventional data available, unquote. So what does that tell you about what's going on here? Is this just a matter of insufficient data? Why is it that it doesn't matter how much data? Have they really come up against, I guess, a roadblock that is not going to be resolved by collecting more data?
Well, you've touched on a very interesting puzzle, and that is, one would expect that if there is a strong historical signal, that is, some pattern present in molecular data that points clearly to one true history, that signal will be reinforced rather than weakened by gathering more information. The problem is that molecular data do not, in many cases, reinforce the previously existing expectation about the tree that ought to be there. In my own work, in my thinking about this, I've seen many, many instances where a molecular systematist or evolutionist will say, I didn't use those genes in my analysis because they gave me the wrong tree. Well, what's going on there? What's going on is he comes to the problem already with an expectation about what he should find. If the molecular data that he's using don't reinforce that, one of the options that he has as an investigator is to drop them out of the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can see that this could be viciously circular. If you only use data that confirm your expectation, in other words, I expect to see tree X, Instead, I see tree Y, so the data that led me to tree Y are bad. They don't have a clear phylogenetic signal, so I'm going to drop them. You can end up having a really awful confirmation bias where you only use the data that give you the tree that you expect. The rest of them are jettisoned. And this, I think, has been a problem endemic in many molecular approaches to the question of the history of life. In my study of these problems, I'm encouraged by seeing younger workers in the field, younger scientists who say we need more rigorous and reproducible methods because of the dangers involved in trying to estimate a history that we can't directly observe. So, for instance, a young worker in Israel has written a PhD dissertation on methods that are used to align DNA sequence data when it's obtained from different organisms. The first analytical step in a molecular analysis after raw DNA sequence data are obtained is to align the sequences to compare them. So you've got, let's say, a DNA sequence from a chimp, a DNA sequence from a rhesus monkey, a DNA sequence from Homo sapiens, and so forth. Those sequences will have many similarities and many differences, and you've got to match them up to find out which are the informative differences and similarities. That's called the problem of alignment. And this young scientist noticed that currently widely used methods of alignment are deeply flawed, leading to problems when those data are then used to build evolutionary trees. So I see many encouraging signs in current work that point to greater rigor in the kinds of problems that you've been describing as you cite these different papers.
And you were talking earlier about assumptions that are brought to the table when they start to do their studies. This paper in Public Library of Science Biology talks about assumptions, and I want to read a quote to you, and I'll make a quick comment, and then I'd like to get your opinion. So they say that, quote, the recurring discovery of persistently unresolved clades, bushes, should force a reevaluation of several widely held assumptions of molecular systematics, unquote. Now, of course, one of the assumptions they do not recommend reevaluating is that of common descent itself. They're looking more at the rates of evolution and so forth, which we'll get into in just a minute here. But what do you make of a statement like that when they're saying things like that? What do you think of this?
Well, I actually, when I read that paper, I was struck by the depth of insight that Carol and Rokas brought to the problem. Both of them, and in fact that whole lab there, the Sean Carroll lab, very, very interested in questions of evolution and how to reconstruct the large-scale patterns in the history of life. The problem is that as they describe in the paper, the molecular data, in many cases, do not have sufficient power to allow you to get an actual tree. What happens is what comes out is what they call an unresolved bush, where everything seems to burst from one point, and there's no structure there. If you look at your own family history, you know, if some people listening to this may be interested be involved in projects of genealogy, reconstructing their family history, there is a real structure, a tree-like structure to your own personal family history. Aunts, uncles, parents, and so forth, it falls out into a neat pattern where each node has a name attached and so forth. Now, imagine that you've got data from your family history, and you can't resolve anything. It's just a bush where there's no clear pattern. Just everything is connected at one node. That's not satisfying. That's not a real history. So what Carroll and his co-author are looking at here is this problem that molecular data seem in many cases not to give a clear structure, a clear family history, but in fact an unresolved bush. To my mind, what this raises at a deeper level is the possibility that the history that they're trying to reconstruct of common ancestry may not be there. Now, I need to stress, this is not the view that Rokas and Carroll themselves would come to. For them, as I said in an earlier podcast, common ancestry is part of the furniture of reality. It's not up for grabs. What they are pointing to, though, is the extreme difficulty of reconstructing that history with respect to the data that we now have in hand. I would be thrilled, and in fact I'm hopeful, that perhaps at some point in the future they would be willing to reconsider their even deeper assumption, namely that there is a real common ancestry there to be pulled out. Mm. It may be that, in fact I think it's the case in the history of science, that oftentimes the questions that we put to nature are not answered in the terms that we may prefer. And perhaps the deep question they're putting to nature, what is the common ancestry, let's say, of the animals, may need to be rethought. And in fact, the signal that nature is trying to give back to them is there wasn't a tree that unites all animals, that there are discrete groups there. And perhaps a better way to think about this question is in terms of not a tree, but independent forest of unrelated of unrelated groups. That's a radical idea.
That's radical. That's evaluating a lot of their assumptions, changing things.
Well, as I said in an earlier podcast, nature talks back to us. And if the questions we're asking her reflect not what's really out there, but our own preconceptions about what we want to see or the kind of pattern we would prefer, sometimes she shouts loud and clear, and we have to go back and change the questions.
And then you're just supposed to talk back at her. You're supposed to shout back louder, right? Well, maybe that's sometimes what we see happening. And so, Paul, I know that this is a very complicated subject, and there's probably a lot more you could say and a lot of nuances that we would need to say in order to really accurately and fully represent this whole subject. Even, you know, this Antonis and Carroll paper, they do go on and propose a new method of trying to create phylogenies using these rare genome events, which they think will solve the problem. And perhaps we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But regardless, you know, we've seen a lot of predictions of common descent. We've seen where a lot of them have failed. And we're often told when we watch PBS, when we read these booklets from the National Academy of Sciences, that common descent, there's a very rosy picture that's painted, and that everything is fitting together very nicely and neatly, and that really this is one of the best confirmations we're told of evolution. I was debating with a relative recently who said, what about the DNA? It confirms evolution. And I said, well, depends on whether you read the stuff for public consumption or if you actually read the papers. And so, you know, where does this leave us? Where are we really at here?
Well, I think it's very important to recognize that much of what is put forward in the name of evolutionary theory, claims about, for instance, molecules confirming fossils or confirming anatomy in every respect, the so-called twin-nested hierarchy that we discussed earlier, where the tree of life from fossils and anatomy is strongly confirmed by the tree of life from molecular data. Anyway, that much of that is belied or a shadow falls across it in terms of papers like the one we've been discussing. I've learned over the past 25 years as a student of all of this that one needs to weigh such claims very, very carefully, or put it another way, with significant skepticism, and to try to get as much as possible into the primary literature, into those things that scientists themselves publish as they think about these very hard problems, to move away from the public rhetoric into the actual practice of the science. I find it quite striking that when one does that, these unequivocal, forceful claims, you know, the DNA confirms the tree of life that we already knew, that those tend to fall away and one finds much more uncertainty, much more care, and really a much more interesting science where people are struggling with real data, how to make sense of it, and that's exciting.
Listening to Mother Nature.
Listening to Mother Nature carefully, yes.
Yes. Well, Dr. Paul Nelson, thank you very much for these podcasts on common descent. It's a real pleasure to have you here in the studio to do this.
Please don't call me Dr. Nelson. Around my house, that's my wife, Suzanne, who's a pediatrician. If you're going to attach a label to me, let it be Paul.
Okay, Paul. Well, sometimes our guests say call them doctors, so I appreciate your informality here. Thank you so much for coming, Paul.
I really enjoyed it.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast signing off. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.